Okay, so we're here at Cass Winery. This is Neil Monins of winerelease.com down in Paso Robles. And we're here with Steve Cass of Cass Winery and also Randall Dennis, who's a friend of mine and helps me out as a little co-host. Thank you, Steve, for taking the time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
Okay, so when did Cass Winery begin? It's a relative newcomer to Paso.
We opened the tasting room May of last year, just about 1 year ago this weekend.
Okay.
The vineyard was planted in 2001. We bought the property in 99. It was a cow pasture. It had been dry farmed from at some time or another in the distant past, because we found lots and lots of old hunks of metal from old tractors and farm implements as we were installing the winery and the barn building here that we displayed over on a table underneath that oak tree behind you, and trying to figure out what the heck those pieces are. When we dug the foundation for this barn, we found the remnants of an old building. It was old residence, apparently. It didn't have any copper in it. It was just all steel pipe for the water. So we're thinking the house was probably torn down and buried maybe 50 or 60 years ago. And of course, you wouldn't tear down a house unless it was 50 or 60 or older years old. So we're thinking it must have been a house put in around the turn of the century. There's an old, very shallow well, which is dry now. It's only 100 feet deep. And nowadays, you got to go down to 300 feet at least to get any water, even though we're right next to the Huero riverbed here.
And then, so you started the winery, or you built the winery last year, and how long have you been making wine?
2003 was our first vintage. We pruned the vineyard really conservatively, knowing that back in 2003 there wasn't a great market for grapes, so even had we aggressively pursued building a big crop, it might have been tough to sell it anyway. And it's always best for the long-term health of the vineyard to prune very conservatively, and it, as it turns out, it paid off really handsomely. In 2003, we only had about 40 tons. We kept about 15 of it for this winery and had Dan Kleck make it for us. 2004, it went to 250 tons, and Dan Kleck also made that wine, along with three other winemakers, Allison up at Byington in Los Gatos, Mike Mooney over Chateau Margine made the Cabernet, Dan made the Syrah, and the Mourvèdre was made by Matt Trevison over at Lenné Collado, who's pretty well known for Rhone variety. Kind of picked them because they each had a reputation for making high-quality wine in the particular varieties that they were making wine at. This was the harvest before we had all of our facilities in place. So last year, 2005, was the first year we did everything under our own roof, and it was so much easier. The logistics of getting barrels and used barrels and new barrels and barrel racks delivered to four different locations and then retrieved back from four different locations to do bottling was killing me.
And you said 40 tons?
40 tons was a total harvest in 2003.
What's that come off of? How many acres does that equate to?
That came off 160 acres.
160 acres.
So put it in perspective. This year, now that the vineyard is pretty mature, we got about 5 tons of grapes per acre, which is relatively standard for, you know, high-quality premium grapes. That year, we had some sections that were only 100 pounds per acre. So instead of having 20 clusters per plant, we had one cluster per 20 plants. We had to pick 80 acres in order to get 4 tons of Cabernet that year.
And why was that?
Because we pruned so conservatively, there wasn't any cordon out on the wire. You had a trunk that went up to the wire, but rather than let a skinny little cordon the size of your pinky go out on the cordon out on the wire, we cut it right back to the trunk. So the next year, you get more robust, thicker cordon going out there, which is that long-term health I was talking about. If you're a little too aggressive with trying to produce crop when the plants are real young, you'll get a trunk and cordons are significantly thinner as the plant gets more mature. And then a plant that should be very easily and in a healthy way able to carry 5 tons an acre, you might find you're only getting 3 or 4 tons. Or the plant shuts down early and doesn't even ripen the plants. So we want to be really conservative in the early years of pruning. That's the primary reason why we had such a low yield that first year. All you had is a cluster or two coming out right at the wire where the trunk came up and started to spread out. Well, the next year, we got maybe a foot or so of cordon out on either side, and now we've got the full stretch of cordon out, the full 6 feet of cordon out. So we're pretty much at full maturity right now. Last year, 2005, we were at 725 tons. So we went from 40 to 250 to 725. which is a sign of the vineyard maturing. So, and that's pretty much where we'll peak out. I don't see us doing much more than 800, maybe 900 tons max.
Tell us how you decided on the varietals, which varietals that you decided to put in.
Back up just a little bit before that even, I ended up getting in this business because I wanted to have my own business, and because I was a wine drinker and I enjoyed drinking wine and going to wineries and living in a rural atmosphere. So this all kind of came together as a great opportunity to have my own business in something that I really enjoyed. But I never intended to be a winemaker or intended to be the vineyard manager myself. I came from more of a technology background. So when we had the conversation about what plants should we put in the ground, I was telling our vineyard manager, John Crossland. John comes with about 25 years of vineyard management experience. I said, well, you know, I think Chardonnay is a great wine, and I love drinking Cabernet. Maybe that's what we should plant. And he set me straight real quickly that the strategy you want to have when you're planting a vineyard is to plant what's going to do well for the environment that you're in. So we're clearly in a hot weather environment, and there's all sorts of research and information that'll tell you what varieties do well in cool weather, moderate weather, or hot weather. So we picked only varieties that did really well in hot weather. Well, then we took another look at what are the soils that we have here, and all of our Rhone varieties are ONTAB certified plants. So you can go to the ONTAB book and find the research from those clones that'll tell you which varieties and which rootstocks do well for the soil types that you have. So it's not as sort of hit and miss as it might sound like. You know, once you get rid of the cool weather plants, and once you say, I want to stay away from moderate weather, but only pick them if I need to, and focus mostly on hot weather, and you know you've got 80% of clay loam and maybe 20% of sandy loam, so that helps you narrow down what you want to do. Then you really just have to say, well, what's the market then for those ones that are left? Well, I have a lot of Cabernet here because a lot of Cabernet is sold in this country. And I've got Grenache, Mauvais, Viognier, Marsan. Those are popular, but not nearly as popular as Cabernet. So if I were to plant, for example, 80 acres of Marsan, there's nobody that would buy that much fruit or could buy that much fruit because there's not that much drunk. So you have to almost plant it in proportion to what the marketplace is actually buying. You can't go crazy and say, well, just because I love Viognier, the whole world should love it, and I'm going to come up with 400 tons. Nobody makes that much.
But you also have to predict 7 years out by the time you plant and it's ready to produce.
Where are the trends going?
Yeah, it's tough to do that. You know, there's always been this sort of ABC phenomenon going on with the whites, you know, anything but Chardonnay. And since Chardonnay wouldn't do well here anyway, that was never really an option for us, and that's why we put in some Viognier and Marsan and Rosan, but in relatively small lots, knowing no one's going to be selling a million cases of it.
Being a wine drinker then, and having a preference based in Cabernet and Chardonnay, and now that you're growing different varietals, are you finding that you enjoy more wines than you even used to previously?
I can't remember the last time I drank Chardonnay now. It's been a long time. After starting to come down here and drinking wine down here, I started to enjoy the Rhone varieties and the Rhone blends quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I ended up making the decision to open the winery and have the winery focus on Rhone wines, largely on a couple of trips that I took to South Africa that started off more as vacations and animal viewing, but ended up being wine tasting and meeting with some of the winemakers down there and tasting the way that they were making Rhone wines in small batches and the way they were blending them. And, of course, knowing that I've got a lot of Rhones and knowing they're all ONTAB certified fruit, so it's really genuine, high-quality plant material that we're starting with as a base, that's what convinced me to go with Rhone. That in combination with the fact that Paso is becoming well-known for Rhone varieties. Like today is Hospice de Rhone, as you probably know.
We're obviously attending. Mm. We were out there all day yesterday. Are you pouring at that event this year?
Ted is pouring for us today.
Okay.
My partner, he and I take turns on various pouring events.
So now, as the owner, you are not the grower in this situation, nor are you your own winemaker.
Correct.
You are truly the owner with your business partner?
I own the vineyard 100% with my wife and I.
Okay.
And the vineyard manager is John Crossland. John started off in viticulture in the Central Valley straight out of college. Managed the vineyards for Andy Beckstoffer up in Napa for 11 years. He's one of the biggest growers in the Napa area. And now has had his own vineyard management business here in the Paso area for the last 7 or 8 years. Now he designed the vineyard for me in the beginning, and now still manages it. So he's, you know, forgotten more than I could ever know. I mean, right. my philosophy had been to try to hire the best people that you can.
And the winemaker?
Dan started off making our wines, but he also is a consulting winemaker for other brands, including his own. So last year I brought in an assistant winemaker from South Africa. His name's Luid Kotsia.
Is that the plan then, to leave him in charge of your winemaking?
And he would be here full-time year-round at that point. Mm.
Still no personal itch to take it on? Is there any desire in you growing to want to try to make it?
We get really involved, but not to the point of making the final chemistry decisions. I mean, I still do all the topping of the wines and harvest. I'm involved with helping get the grapes crushed. I help with virtually every aspect of it, but some of the serious decisions that require a chemistry kind of background, that's not the area I'm interested in going. Just between the marketing and sales of the wine and of the grapes in the vineyard, and sort of managing the overall winery and the overall vineyard is a full-time job.
Tell me about, again, as the wines you're trying to make, you settled in, you did research, you settled in on Rhone varietals. Is there a particular style of Rhone varietals that you see yourself pushing towards?
There is, actually. I didn't actually know this before, and some people might not believe me, but Chateau Neuf de Pape grapes wines are largely Grenache and Mourvèdre based. And I would say that they copied me, except they started so much before I did. I didn't know. But our very first year of doing blends, we put a 20% Syrah into our Mourvèdre blend and about 40% Syrah into our Grenache blend. And in the end, they tasted like a Syrah blend. And to me, Syrah goes really well with some heavy meat dishes, steak Diane, beef Wellington, those kinds of things. But you're not going to have it with chicken or fish. So we decided starting in 2004 to dial back the amount of Syrah that's in blends that are not meant to be a Syrah blend. So the 2004 Mourvèdre blend is actually just Mourvèdre and Grenache, mostly Mourvèdre, and that's truly a Chateau Neuf de Pape kind of blend. And the Grenache has only got 10% Syrah, just enough to give it the backbone to retain its color for a period of time. And by doing that, it really brings out the fruitiness that's in Grenache and in Mourvèdre that's otherwise disguised by the more the chocolatiness of Syrah. So now you've got a red wine that goes well with grilled chicken and pork loin and pastas and sauces. It's not just a steak wine. I mean, I love Syrah, and I think the best wine that I have at this winery is a Syrah, and it's still in the barrel. It'll come out next month. But by opening up these other two wines to other kinds of food, I think it makes much more interesting pairings.
Okay.
So we're a Chateau Neuf de Pape copier, but not on purpose.
But that's the style that you enjoy and that you see yourselves going towards. Of the 22 different Rhone varietals, which ones, then, are you planting here?
We have Petit Syrah, we have Syrah, we have Marsanne, we have Grenache, Mourvèdre, Viognier, Rossan.
Oh, heavens, many of them.
Whatever that adds up to, seven or eight.
I didn't realize you were that heavily planted. And are you using all of your own grapes, or are you actually selling or needing to contract and buy more from other sources?
No, it's kind of the other way. We only use about 10% of the grapes off the vineyard, and the rest of the grapes are sold to other wineries.
Okay.
I mean, that gives us room, obviously a lot of room to grow and still be 100% estate grown. We have no intention of ever taking grapes off any other vineyard except our own.
All right.
On the other hand, we don't really have any intention of using every grape here and becoming that big. I like the idea of just staying at 4,000 or 5,000 cases and making high-end wines and a boutique winery kind of processing.
You're saying 4,000 to 5,000 cases, and you did 1,200 last year. Is that what you did?
Last year we sold 1,000 cases last year out of the 1,200 total.
Okay.
We probably poured and gave away the other 200.
So you're about a fourth of the size that you envision getting in the future.
At this moment, yeah. This year, by the time we're done bottling in August, we will have bottled 3,300 cases this year. So this year we're going to sell some wine out into distribution channels. So if you're having dinner at a restaurant in Los Angeles or San Francisco, you'll be able to find our wine. But it's going to take probably till the end of the year to get out there into a decent number of places.
How many states have you been able to penetrate? How many states is Cass being sold in right now?
We hope to be in Texas and Georgia soon. I just talked to Chicago yesterday, and I hope to be in Chicago. Mostly we're in California right now. Mm-hmm. We have a distributor in Southern California, Northern California, and Central. Three different distributors, each covering a region of the state. And that's where the wines are being sold today. But we're not far away from getting those other states going.
Fantastic.
When you have a relationship with a distributor, the last thing in the world they want to do is convince somebody to buy your wine, and then they go to do a reorder and find out you're out, you don't have any more. So we're really small, so we don't want to overextend ourselves and make commitments we can't back up with a little bit of wine.
Right.
Because I doubt we'll ever get any bigger than that.
Now, in terms of the different types you're going to actually produce, because a lot of these wines just sounds like you're going to be blending, which are you going to do single varietal bottles?
We're going to do a Syrah, single varietal, Viognier, Roussan, Cabernet. Oh, I shouldn't say single varietal. Cabernet this year we're going to blend in 25% Cab Franc. And I'm going to do a standalone Cab Franc at least one time. I'm not sure if I'll do it again, but we like it enough this year that we're going to do a small amount as a standalone. Oh, I got to tell you, I've also got a late harvest Roussan. We had about 2 tons of Roussan hanging in the vineyard that were unsold at the end of the year. We let them hang until mid-December. It rained the first week in December, so we got a big infestation of noble rot, or botrytis, you've probably heard that term. When we went through and picked, we picked only the botrytis-infected bunches and left everything else hang. So it was the ugliest, nastiest pile of grapes you've ever seen.
Sounds yummy.
It came out 45 bricks.
Wow.
Now, put it in perspective, you know, you normally pick for wine at 24 to 26 bricks, and if you're doing a late harvest, you might be 30 to 35 bricks. I've never heard of 45 bricks. So it's just finished fermenting about 3 weeks ago. It's right now at 12% alcohol, 28% residual sugar. It's phenomenal.
Ice cream topping.
Yeah. Pancake sauce.
So what other experiments do you think you're going to do in the next coming harvests?
Last year, Lou had made a sparkling wine for us. Made it out of 60% Grenache, 40% Viognier. Of course, we're doing it in very small amounts. We don't have any of the heavy processing equipment to do large quantities. One of the keys to our success would be to get the Grenache 100% clear. So Grenache will grow enormous amounts of fruit if you let it. And what we do in order to improve the color is we crop the fruit down to about 4 tons per acre. So if the plant wants to carry 12 tons per acre, we cut away 8 tons during the middle of the growing season. Well, for Champagne, we wanted it to be light in color. So for the Champagne, we designated 2 rows and just never touched them. And it was just ungodly amounts of fruit. But when we picked it and brought it in here and crushed it and pressed it off right away, it came out like White Zinfandel, just a really slight hint of pink. So after we cold stabilized it and finished fermentation, even that light pink went away and it became as clear as Chardonnay. So we blended it in with the Viognier, which if there had been any hint of pink, would have knocked out the last of it. So it's fermenting. We've got 1,800 bottles, or 150 cases, fermenting inside the bottle right now in the back. Lou had wants to let it sit there for 5 years before we bottle it, or do the final bottling, the disgorging in that process. But we'll probably do just 10 or 20 cases a year to figure out how to do it in a manual environment. You know, I think what we're going to have to do is buy a bunch of dry ice. The riddling process should go pretty quick. With Champagne, since you're fermenting inside the bottle, you get that sort of scummy brown stuff that settles to the bottom of the bottle, and you need to get that out of there. So riddling in the old days meant putting the bottle almost upside down and turning it every day for a long period of time until all that brown stuff is right up by the crown cap. And then you'd pop open the crown cap, and the pressure that's built up in the bottle from the CO2 fermentation spits that out against the wall, and then you just top the bottle off with another bottle of Champagne, put the cork back in, and you're ready to go. Mm-hmm. Well, nowadays, there's ingredients that you can add to the yeast that makes the settling of the yeast happen faster. It makes it kind of clump together, so the riddling process is only 4 or 5 days instead of 30 or 60 days. And we'll probably just use dry ice. So we'll take the bottle after it's been riddled, stick it in dry ice for, we're thinking it'll be 3 or 4 minutes. We'll figure that out when we do it the first time. That'll freeze it or firm it up. Then we can go through that disgorging process on a small basis just to see how it works. We opened a few bottles just to taste test them, and it's tasting really good. It's very, very bright, very lemony. It's got lots and lots of bubbles. We've had one or two bottles break open, explode. We not that we can see them because they're buried at the bottom of these huge bins, but we can smell that there's some bottles to be cleaned up at the bottom when we finally get to them.
That's a fun experiment, then. That sounds like a very good one.
Well, we're excited. We want it to be really a high-end champagne, the kind that you save for special occasions. And we invited our customers to dream up names for us, and we're collected 400 ideas. And the name that we ended up liking the most was Dan Kleck, our winemaker's suggestion, was Incognito. And the idea was that it's a red wine that looks like a white wine. But now, since then, I've noticed at least two other wines that are named Incognito, so maybe we can't get away with that one.
Right.
We might have to go through the whole naming process again.
Well, the listeners to this podcast, then they can log on to your website and submit suggestions.
Log on to the website, send it to info at castwines.com.
Send names.
And what we promise to do, if somebody does come up with a name that just really works, we'll give them the first case of wine that comes out of the process.
For the special reserve champagne.
Correct.
Personal favorites. You did mention that your favorite wine here is the Syrah. How about favorite pairings? You're at home, you're in your own kitchen, you sit down, you open what, and you enjoy it with what the most?
I took our Mourvèdre blend, which we call Hacienda. It's 70% Mourvèdre, 30% Grenache. The Mourvèdre's got a peppery note to it, and I took it down to a nice restaurant in Los Angeles with me and had a ahi tuna that was raw in the middle, seared with a bright peppery crust on the outside, and the two of those just exploded in your mouth. It was fantastic. I love doing the Mourvèdre and Grenache combinations with foods that would normally be considered white wine foods.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm entitled to ask a silly question, right?
Sure.
We're pulling in. There's a weather vane on top of the windmill, water mill thing here. Can you describe it, because we're on radio and people can't see, and where does this come from? Is that a local artist, or?
The artist is Philip Glashoff. The name of the art, we named it Laura. I'll tell you why in a second. But it's if you imagine what Superman looks like when he's flying, but instead of a man, it's a woman, and she's kind of a silver-colored or stainless steel color, apparently naked. She's holding a glass of wine in her outstretched right hand as she's flying through the air. She's sitting on top of our windmill with 30 or 40 feet up in the air. Between her ankles is a giant metal cutting blade that basically acts as a wind vane. So as the wind blows, she spins around and is pointing in the direction of the wind. We are looking for artwork to put on top of that windmill. On a weekend that I went up to the Bay Area to attend the funeral of a woman that had died of multiple sclerosis. Even though she had been in the wheelchair for 20 years, just the prior year, when she could barely even talk on the telephone, she was named Volunteer of the Year in San Rafael, which is a pretty big community. It's quite an honor. So she, 20 years in the wheelchair, she passes away, and there's got to be 1,000 people at her funeral. This woman battled very courageously against a very debilitating disease, and when she was in her healthier days, she enjoyed a glass of wine. So we ended up naming this piece of art Laura.
Wonderful. Yeah. All right. Well, at least it wasn't that silly of a question then.
No.
Because
no,
it was noticeable. I mean, I've been out here before, and right when I pulled in this morning, I noticed it. I guess, lastly, then, future plans for the building itself, for the winery itself. Will you add a B&B, a restaurant? Will this facility get larger?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, I think we talk about it occasionally when we get really jam-packed in the back, maybe putting a barrel storage or case goods storage building in or something like that. But I don't even know if that'll happen. Mm-hmm. I think our objective in the next couple of years is to build our client base so that we can know that we can make 4,000 or 5,000 bottles of really good wine and sell it each year and get ourselves onto a track and sort of out of the development and everything is new mode. We've been in the everything is new mode for a long time now.
Sure.
So you mentioned ONTAV certification earlier. Can you explain that?
ONTAV is an acronym, and it's an agency of the French government. It stands for, and I'm going to butcher this French, and I apologize to anybody that's French, Oenological Nationale Technique d'Amélioration of Viticulture. And it very loosely translated, is like the Department for the Improvement of Grape Growing Practices. 90% of all vineyards that are planted in France are ONTAP certified clones. They'll put a clone of a particular variety in the ground and monitor it for 7 years. Every year, they pull out plants that have signs of virus, where they're overly vigorous or underly vigorous, or there's any growing abnormality whatsoever, they take them out. So as a result, at the end, you have healthy, evenly growing plants. It's really, really important, because even minor variations in the clonal origins of a plant can cause the ripening to be on a different schedule. And for example, I'll tell you that I have four different clones of Cabernet, and they're in four different blocks, 4, 3, 3, 7, 8, and 15. And they ripen 2 to 4 weeks apart. So if they were just all intermingled in one block, and we said, well, we want to pick our Cabernet at 26 bricks. So we'd take our samples from every section of the block, mush them together, put them on the little device that tells you how much sugar it is, and when it says 26 bricks, you pick. Well, if you have a mixture of various clones, you're going to be picking 23 bricks and 29 bricks and 23 bricks and 29 bricks, and an occasional 26 bricks. And all average 26, but 23 is crappy wine, and 29 is crappy wine. You want every berry to be 26. So even though you might have what you think is the greatest winemaker in the world and the greatest vineyard manager in the world, if the plant's DNA says, I'm not ripening the same time as my neighbor here, you're behind the eight ball. It's going to be really difficult to make superior wine. So ONTAP was just certified to sell plant material in California starting in 1996. And so we are one of the very early vineyards to have to make wine that is 100% ONTAP and 100% estate. I think there are a few others. I don't know who they are, but there's not very many of them. Estate bottled wine alone is only 5% of all bottled wine. So when you narrow that down to say, well, who else is not only estate but 100% ONTAP, you really get down to a tiny number. So I think it really gives us the potential for some really superior wines. Every year when we do our picks, we're picking small lots from different sections, barreling them separately, and then tracking the progress. So each year we think we're going to be able to improve upon the prior year, and it's just a matter of time until we get that one superstar, you know, 95 kind of wine that we're shooting for, which is why we're here. There's a very well-known grown house here in Paso Robles called Tablas Creek. If you know about them, the story that you've heard is they brought over their cuttings from France before ONTAP was licensed to do that. And I had the very nice dinner with Robert and Barbara Haas a couple of nights ago, and I was asking them about that. He had started off as a distributor earlier in his career, and he was importing French wine, so he's over in France a lot, and he met the Beaucastel people. And at that time, he couldn't get French wood because ONTAP wasn't licensed to do that, and they were at that time battling it out with UC Davis on what the quarantine process was going to be. So he took it upon himself to bring in his own plants. So he brought in a bunch of plants, and they had to go through a 3-year quarantine. In the end, only 15 of the plants survived. But from those 15 plants, he propagated and took cuttings. And so when you hear the story about Tablas Creek, that's why he did it, and that's what he got. But if you ask him now, well, now that ONTAP is here, would you go through that whole process again? He told me, no, it would be so much easier just to get it from ONTAP and not have to go through that. But he was ahead of his time.
Well, Steve, we really want to thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're appreciate welcome. Thanks for coming out.
Very educational.
I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to now going to taste your wines.
Well, let's go do that.